Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 8 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for spring pre-registration is April 21st. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, our political scientists on board. Rene Rocha is director of Latina and Latino Studies and associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa in our Iowa City studio. Rene, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Jonathan Hasid is in our Ames studio, associate professor of political science at Iowa State University. Jonathan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll get your mic turned on right away there. Let's, in the first half hour, we want to talk about big shakeup, a dramatic shakeup at the highest levels in the Department of Homeland Security. And we'd like to have you join us if you have a question, concern of the political nature with what's been happening in the last few days. We're going to leave the phones off of the options today due to our pledge drive. Email us with your question or comment, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Well, let's discuss that and hear from President Trump yesterday, the president insisting, insisting that he has no plans to separate families. He claimed falsely that President Obama carried out the same plan and maintained his decision to halt that practice last year. And that was the reason, he says, so many Central Americans have been coming to the U.S.
You wouldn't start separating the children again, would you, Mr. President? Would you consider doing it again?
So you understand, President Obama separated the children. Those cages that were shown, I think they were very inappropriate. They were built by President Obama's administration, not by Trump. President Obama had child separation. Take a look. The press knows it. You know it. We all know it. I'm the one that stopped it. President Obama had child separation. Now, I'll tell you something. Once you don't have it, that's why you see many more people coming. They're coming like it's a picnic, because let's go to Disneyland. President Obama separated children. They had child separation. I was the one that changed it.
President Trump repeating a false claim that child separations were carried out by the Obama administration earlier this week. It has been frequently refuted. It was then Attorney General Jeff Sessions who instituted the so-called zero tolerance policy at the southern border. That was in April of 2018. That resulted in children being separated from their parents who were taken into custody for criminal prosecution. Rene, let me go to you first of all. Several facets, of course, we want to talk about the director of Homeland Security being fired as well. But comment on this, the characterization of President put forth by President Trump.
Yeah, well, obviously, there's a lot to pick apart in that statement. I mean, the things that I will say are true is that President Obama did have a very robust immigration enforcement system. You know, during the early years of the Obama administration, we were removing around 400,000 people annually. You know, the Trump administration has been removing around 200, 250,000 people annually. So even a more robust sort of enforcement apparatus than the current president has, I'm not sure he'd be sort of proud to bring out that factoid. But the idea that there was this family separation, that it was sort of a systemized routine part of government policy, that's just obviously not true. There are particular cases in which a parent might be deemed a particular danger to the child in which you might have separation. That's true. That was true during the Obama administration. That's still true today. But the idea that you have, as a matter of course, zero tolerance, criminal prosecutions of everyone who's apprehended at the border. And therefore, since children cannot be detained while their parents are, you know, in custody awaiting criminal prosecution, that you're going to have this forced separation. That is something which has existed only during this several months window during the earlier part of the Trump administration.
Jonathan Hasid, to you, and comment, please, also on the president's characterization of the border crisis.
I mean, one of the interesting things is that Trump has cut off aid, or I don't know if he's followed through, but he certainly threatened to cut off aid to three Central American countries, which are a large source of the refugees that are trying to enter the United States. And so if Trump were serious about wanting to stop the flow of migrants, you would think that aid would be a crucial part of this package. I mean, one of the main objectives of the aid is to get these countries, you know, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, to essentially keep migrants at home, right? Is to build government capacity in these areas. And so, it seems to me that Trump is not really serious about fixing the current system. He, you know, there are many in his administration, perhaps most notably Stephen Miller, who seem to want to stop all immigration entirely. And Trump seems to be leaning in that direction for political reasons, not necessarily because he, you know, wants to stop this. He likes the problem as a political prop rather than as something to fix.
Mm-hmm. Rene, give us a picture, because we have what seems to me conflicting pictures given by the president. On the one hand, since as a candidate, he's called them rapists, drug dealers, and so forth, that they are criminals threatening our society. And then we hear yesterday, they're coming like it's a picnic because let's go to Disneyland. Now, how would you characterize or make sense of that and properly characterize the migrant families coming across now?
Yeah, well, you know, an important thing here is that the type of immigrants that are trying to enter the United States has changed over the past couple of years. So historically, you had a large number of immigrants coming from Mexico, mostly males, coming to be part of our labor market. That has changed. In fact, within the past couple of months, we've had, for the first time in American history, the number of individuals coming sort of through the asylum process being sort of at par, even higher than the number of sort of single male apprehensions that are caught by along the Southwest border sectors. And so that's a fundamentally different type of immigrant, you know, not rapists, not murderers, family unit apprehensions. It also sort of calls for an entirely different set of, you know, public policy decisions. So the idea of building a wall, right, is something that doesn't apply to these family units that are actually presenting themselves to border agents because they're trying to participate in an asylum process. They're not trying to evade apprehension. They're not sort of crossing through remote areas of the Arizona desert. They're going to ports of entry and trying to present themselves. And so sort of like a wall as a policy solution is entirely irrelevant for that type of immigrant.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, courts have been a problem. Court rulings have been a problem blocking what the president wants to do. In fact, on Monday, in the latest of these instances, a federal court in Northern California temporarily blocked the what was termed the Remain in Mexico program, forcing some asylum seekers to wait in Mexico while their claims were pending in U.S. immigration court. Now, many of the actions that the Trump administration has taken on its own have been blocked by the courts. How do you see the courts figuring into this? How are they weighing these actions? On what basis are they making these decisions that the president may not do that?
I mean, the problem for the president is that, you know, we have a bunch of laws about asylum seekers, about immigration, and so the president is trying to wave these laws away with a process that the courts have often determined is arbitrary and capricious. Now, these are key terms. When a court finds that a government has made a decision in an arbitrary and capricious manner, the court tends to throw it out. So essentially, because the Trump administration has been, you know, hasty and trying to use the power of the executive to rewrite laws, which of course is not permitted under our Constitution, he's gotten in trouble with the courts. And his response has often been to denigrate the courts entirely. A few days ago, or maybe a couple of weeks ago, I forget exactly when, Trump said that, you know, why do we have these judges? Perhaps we should get rid of judges, right? So he's saying that the judiciary is blocking him so much that the United States doesn't need a judiciary anymore. But of course, under our Constitution, we have one. And so this
inconvenient... It's one of the three pillars of our government.
That's right. That's right. And so it can't just be wished away. You know, facts may have disappeared in political life, but facts and the law still matter in courts in America. And the courts are duty-bound to follow the laws and to follow the facts, and the facts often and the law often are not favorable terrain for the Trump administration. And so Trump rails against the whole system.
Mm-hmm. One of the facets of this, of course, that Kirstjen Nielsen forced out as the Secretary of Homeland Security, even after carrying out and defending President Trump's hardline immigration policies. Rene, to you first, what do you make of that? She was, or was she not, carrying out what the president wanted?
Yeah, I mean, gosh, what's happened in the Department of Homeland Security over the past week has been, you know, sort of Shakespearean melodrama. You know, first, the Trump administration rescinded the nomination of the acting head of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, who was being nominated to hold the position permanently, did so without warning DHS that was going to happen, which then resulted in the eventual Forced removal of Secretary Nielsen, right? I think that, so this is related to your previous question. When you talk about the legal process being sort of stacked against the Trump administration, Secretary Nielsen was one of the individuals who, although executing many of Trump's policies, was sort of set to privately try to put the brakes on some of these things to warn the Trump administration that the policies would be, warned constitutional, would never sort of hold up to judicial scrutiny if they pushed them forward.
Right, and was reported to have heated conversations with the president about this.
And growing frustrated, the president and Stephen Miller, who's sort of the unofficial official immigration czar now, decided that they were better off just removing her and perhaps replacing her with somebody who will more aggressively pursue the president's priorities over at DHS.
Okay. I'd like to have you comment on this too, Jonathan. But before you do, let's also listen to U.S. Senator Chuck Schumer, the minority leader, speaking on the Senate floor. I believe this is yesterday or even perhaps today, regarding the departure of the Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen and also the Secret Service Director departed, Director Randolph Ailes. Let's listen to what Senator Schumer had to say about the president's actions here.
This is further proof that the president is kowtowing to the worst instincts of people and to the conservative, hard right, and extreme voices in the Republican Party, with no or little regard for our national security or the ability to function efficiently. And what he's done by these constant firings and constant change of policy has simply created chaos at the border. Nobody knows what the policy will be from day to day and week to week and month to month. He doesn't tell the top people in his departments that he's changed his plans. He fired, evidently, Mr. Vitiello without even Secretary Nielsen knowing about it. This erratic, nasty style of governing is not solving any problems at the border.
Senator Chuck Schumer, Jonathan Haseed, how do the Democrats fit in here? Have they, for instance, are they offering any alternative solutions to what has become a crisis on the border?
Not particularly. The Democrats are trying to stay out of this particular fight. Now, the Democrats in the past have tried to offer deals with the Trump administration. So, for example, wall funding in exchange for an extension of DACA. That was the Obama-era program that allowed people who arrived in the United States illegally as children to remain here. But it was killed by the Trump administration, apparently, and perhaps by Stephen Miller's influence. And so for now, I think, the Democrats don't want to be accused of being open border, right? This is a potentially powerful political slogan that can be used against them. And so they're criticizing the Trump administration's actions without really offering a sort of comprehensive solution of their own. But I do want to add that a lot of the criticism of Trump's recent actions in firing a whole bunch of senior staff at the Department of Homeland Security, the criticism hasn't just come from the Democrats. Our own Senator Grassley said a couple of days ago that he was deeply troubled by the way that the Trump administration has been removing officials left and right, and he sort of worries that there's a vacuum at the top of Homeland Security. And so this is maybe the one issue where there seems to be a bit more pushback inside the GOP against Trump. I think Joni Ernst, our other senator, had a similar kind of a statement of concern about this. And so it may be that Trump is finally finding an issue on which at least some Republicans in the Senate are willing to publicly push back a bit.
Mm-hmm. So, Renee, the Republican members of Congress, leaders, our own congressional members in the Republican Party, not, it sounds like, in lockstep with the president's sort of impromptu policy changes on immigration.
Yeah, and it's hard to really exaggerate the depth to which we're going through acting people and having to go sort of and how deep that goes into the administration of some of these organizations, some of these units. So, for example, when the president fired Secretary Nielsen, he tried to replace that individual with the head of Customs and Border Protection. But he was actually statutorily blocked from doing that. And there's actually another individual who is the sort of director of the Office of Management at DHS that is slated to take over as acting director of DHS in the event that the secretary resigns or is fired. And so the Trump administration had to then force the resignation of that individual in order to create the vacancy that would allow the head of Customs and Border Protection to become acting secretary of Homeland Security. So the number of people they've had to remove in that organization in order to execute this plan, this sort of like decapitation of DHS leadership, is really large and gets, you know, it's very complicated. The number of names and personalities here is difficult to keep track of sometimes.
Okay, we'll do our best to keep track of it, providing analysis today, and we're so glad they're on board. Rene Rocha, director of Latino Studies and on the faculty of the Political Science Department at the University of Iowa. Jonathan Hasid at Iowa State University, where he's on the faculty there of Political Science. Join us with your questions via email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Ben Kiefer, back to talk about many other items in politics. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 8 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for spring pre-registration is April 21st. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
We're back. More of this special pledge drive edition of River to River. It's Politics Wednesday, and joining me today, Jonathan Hasid of the Political Science Department of Iowa State University, Rene Rocha of the Political Science Department at the University of Iowa, our two political scientists on board to pick apart, as we always like to do, the last few days of politics. And of course, it's coming fast and furious. All the developments in the first half hour, we talked about the Department of Homeland Security, all of the upheaval there. Let's move on to another piece of big news from the last few days. It's been a little more than 2 weeks since Robert Mueller wrapped up that 22-month-long probe into whether members of the president's campaign colluded with Russia during the White House race and if he obstructed official inquiries into the matter. Now, yesterday, the U.S. Attorney General William Barr told lawmakers he intends to release, in his words, within a week, a redacted version of this long-awaited report on Russian interference in the 2016 election. During the congressional hearing, Barr was repeatedly challenged by Democrats who raised suspicions that he may have misinterpreted Mueller's report to paint the Republican president in a better light. Remember, all we have so far outside of a very small circle is a 4-page summary by the attorney general who was appointed by this president. Barr said he would be as open as possible about redactions of sensitive information when he hands over the full document. To you first, Jonathan, your thoughts about the attorney general's testimony to Congress yesterday.
It concealed as much as it revealed. I mean, obviously, we'll have to wait to see what the report reveals. But I will like to note that the Starr report, the very long Starr report that Ken Starr did when he was investigating Bill Clinton's presidency, was released without redactions to Congress.
Zero
redactions, including grand jury testimony. So one of the things that Barr has claimed is that he cannot release things like sensitive grand jury testimony to Congress because grand jury testimony can only be used inside judicial proceedings. However, there's other precedent that establishes that Congress's investigative abilities count as judicial proceedings. And so Barr seems to be doing a little bit of hand-waving here, perhaps around DOJ policy, saying that he can't turn things over when precedent seems to have established that, in fact, he can. Mm-hmm. And so perhaps this demonstrates that, once again, that he is, perhaps protecting his boss, protecting President Trump. We should recall that before he became attorney general, and perhaps one of the key reasons he was picked, was that he wrote a lengthy report essentially decrying the entire investigation. Saying
unsolicited.
Unsolicited, correct. He wrote a report, criticizing the Mueller investigation, saying it should never have been done. And a lot of people think that that's why he was picked to be attorney general to replace Jeff Sessions. And so if Barr is improperly defending Trump, then we're going to expect a lot of fights, and it's going to ultimately wind up in the courts.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, quickly, will Congress get to see the full unredacted report?
I think they will.
They will. It'll eventually come out. It may take some time.
I think so. I think the courts are, there's plenty of precedent that says that the courts should allow it to be released. Mm-hmm. The Democrats may have to do some procedural maneuvers. Like, it's possible that the Democrats may actually have to start formal impeachment hearings because that makes it a judicial process.
Right.
And so that will allow, at least in theory, the law would seem to indicate that that would allow a formal release of the report. Now, this is all going to go through the courts, but given the way the courts have ruled on similar matters in the past, I would be surprised if we didn't end up seeing the whole report. Now, this may take years, right? This may happen after the next presidential election.
Really?
Could be.
Mm-hmm. What about us? I mean, I've heard that if Congress gets a hold of it, then there will inevitably be a leak, and the public will get, I don't know, a full version, redacted version, some version. What about us here, taxpayers, the American public? Will we get to see this report, Jonathan? How much?
If it goes to all 535 members of Congress, then so we'll see it. Someone's going to leak it.
Okay.
Yes.
What are your thoughts, Renee, as we think about this report and when it will come out in a redacted version, I guess, we assume first?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are two ways to sort of think about these events. And one is, you know, they're important in and of themselves. The American people have a right to know. But then there's also what the practical implications, what the political implications of this are. And, you know, we've seen the president's approval rating range, you know, somewhere in the low 40s for months, years. And there's no real indication that I can, you know, that I would see to suggest that the report, if it contains very sort of controversial material in it, very material that's suggestive of, obstruction of justice or other types of, you know, suggestions of criminal activity, that would have a significant negative effect on his approval rating. I think most Republican partisans are ready to dismiss this thing out of hand and ready to focus on other things, like the things which the Attorney General has just mentioned in, you know, the news clip they played at the top of the hour, where they have accusations now that the Trump campaign was being spied on by the federal government. And let's go investigate that. And you just get in this tit for tat, and you just end up with a lot of cross signals that just end up canceling each other out.
Yeah. The Attorney General, you heard in the top of the hour, the NPR News, the William Barr defending a decision to order a review of the Trump-Russia probe's origins, that he thinks spying did occur by the U.S. government on President Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign. I guess the question is, Jonathan, whether this spying was legitimate.
Right. I mean, he was a little sloppy in how he said it. So first he said he thought there was spying, using that exact word, but then he backtracked a little and said he didn't necessarily mean that it was improper.
Right. And spying, when we think of spying, we think improper.
That's right. Spying
that's
is definitionally improper.
Right.
An investigation, you know, done by the FBI in pursuant to a judicial warrant is definitionally not spying. And so, you know, he seemed to want to have his cake and eat it too, Attorney General Barr. On the one hand, he says that the Trump administration was spied on, but then a few minutes later he said, well, no, by spying I mean maybe just investigated, right? And so I think Renee is right that this is, it does seem to be a tit for tat, right? There was this, from the perspective of the Trump administration, there was this supposedly partisan investigation into him, and so now he wants to turn the tables on the Democrats.
Join our discussion via email if you'd like to, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, with our fundraiser going on. We're leaving the phones to the side for this special pledge drive edition of Politics Wednesday with Jonathan Haseed and Rene Rocha. Let's talk about another big political story this week. Donald Trump holding steady on his refusal to publicly release his tax returns. There's pressure from Congress for their disclosure. Speaking to reporters at the White House, Trump said Americans did not care about that issue and maintained that his returns were being audited by the IRS. We note here, of course, that tax and legal experts, I believe even the head of the IRS, came out this week and says that just doesn't. That doesn't go. We can release taxes. Anybody can release tax returns even while being audited. Today is the deadline. The House Democrats have given the IRS commissioner to turn over 6 years of the president's personal and business tax returns to the House Ways and Means Committee. Chairman Richard Neal, Democrat from Massachusetts, the White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney said Sunday Trump's tax returns will never be handed over to Democratic lawmakers. Renee, what do you think this is all about? Is this a partisan tit for tat? Is there something in these tax returns that we should have legitimate access to?
Well, I think we'll find out. I feel pretty confident at this point that the Democrats are going to be able to get a hold of the returns, and they're going to be able to get a hold of the returns fairly soon. But I think it's also educating to see where Republicans are. You mentioned before the break that there are some cracks amongst Republican lawmakers in terms of being concerned about the number of acting agency heads in the Trump administration, and he's getting some pushback. Here's the case in which I think we've seen Republican lawmakers close ranks. You even had Senator Romney, who for years had said that President Trump or candidate Trump at the time should release his tax returns, flip and now be on the side of saying that, in fact, it would be sort of moronic to continue pursuing this issue. And as you see Republicans sort of close ranks on the president around this, then I think that we're just going to end up with another fight, which is heavily politicized, and the substance and the merits of whatever's going on just get lost in this sort of partisan battle.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, is this struggle by the Democrats to get hold of the tax returns a political stunt, as the GOP would tell you, or a legitimate request grounded in law, as the Democrats would tell you?
Oh, it's both. I mean, the Democrats want to get Trump's returns because they assume that there's something embarrassing or improper in there. And, you know, there probably is, right? Otherwise, Trump would have released them by now. He's not, you know, no one would accuse Trump of being a man who is reticent about his private life or about his fortune. And so if his tax returns, you know, didn't show him in an unfavorable light, then I'm sure he would have released them long ago. Now, that said, it's clear that the Democrats want to go after these returns because they think it's going to embarrass the president. However, the Trump administration doesn't seem to have a lot of legal leeway to fight this. The Great Depression era law that the Ways and Means Committee, led by the Democrats, has used to go after Trump's tax returns says that, at the request of the committee, the IRS, quote, shall release returns, which doesn't legally leave them a lot of wiggle room, right? And now we have reports that the IRS has apparently consulted. There's consultations between the Treasury Department, which runs the IRS, and the White House over these returns. But there's nothing in the statute that allows this kind of consultation. The statute pretty clearly says that if the returns are requested, the IRS shall turn them over. And, of course, they haven't done that. And so this is going to be another court fight. But it would seem to me that the returns are likely to come out, as Renee said. The law as written doesn't seem to give the Trump administration a lot of leeway, a lot of wiggle room to prevent the returns coming out.
Spent a lot of time talking about the president's latest actions in immigration and the bar testimony, Trump on taxes. Let's pivot over to give the Democrats a little bit more of our attention in the last 10 minutes of our program. Democratic Representative Eric Swalwell, he's a California representative in the U.S. House, announced on Monday that he is running for president. He did it Monday night on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. He was born in Sac City, Iowa. He sees a country unable to solve problems and threats from abroad, unable to make life better for people here at home. Here he is with his very first announcement that he's running for president on Stephen Colbert's show.
Nothing gets done. I talk to teachers and truckers and, you know, nurses, and they feel like they're just running in place, and it's not adding up to anything. I talk to people who are just like me, who are the first in their family to go to college. They've got a lot of student debt, can't buy a home, can't start a business. I talk to kids who sit in their classroom afraid that they'll be the next victim of gun violence, and they see Washington doing nothing about it after the moments of silence, and they see lawmakers who love their guns more than they love our kids. And none of that is going to change until we get a leader who is willing to go big on the issues we take on, be bold in the solutions we offer, and do good in the way that we govern. I'm ready to solve these problems. I'm running for president of the United States.
Democratic Representative Eric Swalwell of California, born in Iowa, making his announcement on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert Monday. This makes, Renee, the 18th candidate. I've run out of fingers to count long ago to join the Democratic primary. Pushes the tally above 17 candidates. We had 17 candidates in the 2016 Republican primary. So we've gone above that record. Born and raised in Sac City, Iowa, he made his home in the Bay Area where he lives and represents that part of California.
Yeah. 18, my gosh, I really thought that Republican field was going to be sort of where we ended up as our max, but apparently not, and I'm not sure we're going to stay at 18. So it's hard to know in a field that it's crowded like this, how you really differentiate yourself. And so the idea is to say, well, you know, go big and go bold. At this point in time, the Democrats are in such an arms race. Every major Democratic presidential candidate supports some variant of, say, Medicare for All, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would consider that, or at least I think most people, at least a few years ago, would have considered that bold or big. And now it's sort of standard Democratic platform. And so what exactly is bigger and bolder than some of the proposals that are on the table, Green New Deal, other types of similar initiatives, is not clear to me. So
right.
Being able to differentiate yourself, I think, is going to be increasingly challenging for candidates that don't already have some kind of high name recognition. And that's why it'll be interesting to see what happens, say, if a former Vice President Biden enters the race, you know, how much of oxygen he'll take up out of some of the. And if he doesn't enter the race, or if his candidacy doesn't sort of take off in the way that he expects it to, how much of that oxygen will go to some of these sort of second-tier candidates?
Mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders leading the polls in this packed 2020 Democratic candidates, an undeclared candidate, right? This week, no, Bernie Sanders is declared. Joe Biden, you spoke of just a moment ago, as yet to decide or officially declare. Bernie Sanders this week unveiling an updated version of what you just mentioned, one of his signature proposals, once dismissed, as you pointed out, Renee, as too radical by Democrats, Medicare for All. Now it's really central to how the party talks about health care. I see that we have four of his opponents in the race for president co-sponsoring his universal health care plan in the Senate. I guess we have to define what Medicare for All is. Sanders told CBS News, it guarantees, like every other major country on earth, health care to every man, woman, and child in this country. When asked if his proposal is considered socialism, Sanders, a Democratic socialist, denied it. He said, no, actually it is not. It is similar to what the Canadians have. Jonathan, comment on the way health care has taken center stage for the Democrats and how that is likely or not likely to get traction in 2020.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good issue for the Democrats to run on. You know, the Republicans have campaigned since 2009 on repealing Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. And, of course, they haven't done so, despite numerous votes. And there is essentially no Republican health care plan that, as far as anyone can tell, certainly the Trump administration hasn't revealed one. And so this is a good way for people for the Democrats to differentiate themselves from the GOP on an issue that a lot of people care about. Health care spending in this country is colossal. The U.S. spends now almost 18% of GDP on healthcare, which is far more than any other industrialized country in the world. We get for that 18%, for that enormous spending, we get terrible healthcare outcomes. We have terrible infant mortality statistics. We have poor and declining life expectancy relative to other industrialized countries. And people, of course, hate dealing with insurance companies. You know, the American system is this hodgepodge that nobody would have designed. It's incredibly complicated. Everybody hates it. It's incredibly expensive. It was really salient. Apparently, you know, it was one of the big issues in the midterms, driving the Democratic pickup of 40 House seats. And so I think a lot of Democratic candidates feel now that this is a great issue to run on. Mm-hmm. And there does seem to be a lot of momentum.
Can Jonathan, though, they really run on this issue when the cost is mentioned, a price tag of somewhere between $25 to $32 trillion over the next decade? How do you sell that with that kind of price tag?
Yeah, I mean, clearly, you know, in terms of new government spending, any kind of Medicare for All, any kind of universal health care is going to be massively expensive, and it's going to require a lot of new taxes. But the savings will also be substantial on the private end, right? So one of the reasons that private health care companies drive up the cost of health care, the U.S. health care system is very complicated, and it's not just the health insurance companies, but a lot of cost is driven by the insurance companies, because they have massive overhead. And so countries with universal health care save in aggregate by eliminating a lot of that overhead. So essentially what you'd be doing is you'd be taking a lot of private sector spending and dumping it on the public sector. And if you just look at it on the public sector side, it looks like the public sector will have grown massively. And indeed it will have. But if you just look at overall health care spending, which as I said before is now almost 18% of GDP, you know, a lot of experts think that a universal healthcare system like Canada or Australia's, I have familiarity with the Australia healthcare system, having lived there for a number of years. It worked great. And so I think it's true that it would require massive government spending, but it potentially would shrink the overall healthcare spending pie.
Let me ask you before we go, Jonathan and Renee, about another candidate, a Democratic presidential hopeful who has been getting quite a lot of attention in the past couple of weeks and has been forcing us to hopefully properly pronounce his last name. On Sunday, the Democratic presidential hopeful Pete Buttigieg again took on the vice president, Mike Pence, whose stances on LGBTQ issues have faced criticism from gay rights activists. Buttigieg, a little bit about his background. He's a former naval intelligence officer. He's a graduate of Harvard who has served as the mayor of the city of South Bend, Indiana. Pence from Indiana, of course, also. He's been the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, since 2012. If nominated, he would be the first openly gay and married presidential nominee. Here he is on Sunday addressing the vice president's stance on LGBTQ issues.
You may be religious and you may not, but if you are, and you are also queer, and you have come through the other side of a period of wishing that you weren't, then you know that that message, that this idea that there is something wrong with you, is a message that puts you at war not only with yourself, but with your maker. And speaking only for myself, I can tell you that if me being gay was a choice, it was a choice that was made far, far above my pay grade. And that's the thing I wish the Mike Pences of the world would understand. That if you got a problem with who I am, your problem is not with me. Your quarrel, sir, is with my creator.
Before we go, we have a couple minutes left. Renee, let me start with you. What is the appeal of Buttigieg? Not his name, perhaps his name. I'm making jest of it, of course. But as a candidate, he's getting some more and more attention.
Yeah, and I think some of this attention is occurring mostly amongst Democratic activists or Democratic elites. It'll be interesting to see how much it carries over into sort of the mass public. But you know, I remember the 2012 Republican primary, and the president recently talked about nominating Herman Cain to the Federal Reserve. I remember when Herman Cain was the front runner for the Republican nomination in 2012.
And I do too.
At a different point, it was Newt Gingrich, and a different point, it was And I think it's very easy and it's fun sometimes to get bogged down in who's the candidate of the month, but it's ultimately maybe not the best exercise to dedicate that much of your mental energy into tracing every one of these curves in the road.
Let me go to Jonathan for a minute. We have to end in less than a minute. A comment on Buttigieg and his breaking out of the pack a little bit here in terms of attention getting?
Yeah, well, people like his resume, right? It's very impressive. I think he was a Rhodes Scholar. You know, he's obviously has the military background. He's, you know, the mayor of a sort of medium-sized city, and so that all gives him a good deal of sort of paper experience. And personally, he seems to be well-liked. And, you know, the fact is that he's sort of taken up a lane that isn't we don't often see on the Democratic sides, which is to say that he's religious. And so perhaps he's appealing to the religious left, which is often generally overshadowed in America by the religious right. And we'll see how much traction he gets.
Jonathan Haseeb of the Political Science Department at Iowa State University, Renee Rocha in Political Science on the faculty at the University of Iowa. Jonathan and Renee, thank you for joining us this hour.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer.